The following lecture was delivered at the 18th Annual National Jewish Retreat in Miami, Florida, a project of the Rohr Jewish Learning Institute. We hope you enjoy it. We encourage you to visit jretreat.com for information on upcoming retreats. Rabbi Mendy Katz will now present his lecture, Relax, It's the 21st Century, Jewish Wisdom to Calm Modern Anxieties.
Good afternoon, and thank you all for joining me at the session. I'd like to begin by telling you about Lucy. Lucy was a lady who struggled with anxiety. She had had this condition, she had had these struggles for many years, and she had battled with them for some time. She found that anxiety was dictating her life. She had tried just about every single hack out there. She had gone for therapy, she had tried breathing techniques, she had covered the range of solutions for her anxieties, but she still battled. She hadn't gotten to the core. She wasn't yet able to overcome them. She had read about the benefits of meditation, and she, in her own right, decided it was worth a try. So she went onto her app store, she downloaded a guided meditation app, and she decided she's going to put her heart into it. She's really going to set the stage, set the mood to do this properly. She lights some beautifully scented candles. She dims the lights in the room. She puts on her favorite music, very softly playing in the background. And she lays out her very favorite and most comfortable mat to sit down and begin. A very soothing voice comes over the app and starts instructing. Close your eyes. Imagine you're on a serene beach. The waves are washing ashore and the sun is warming your skin. Lucy's anxiety starts to speak up. You're sitting on a beach. What happens if you get sunburned? What happens if there's something in the sand that you're allergic to? Maybe some sort of creature that's going to bite you. What if? With all her might, she pushes those thoughts aside, and she continues that deep breathing. She's pushing through, and so is the guided voice. The voice comes back over and says, now you're on a serene river. You're floating down peacefully on a beautiful, calm river. The current is carrying you. And you are completely relaxed. Here comes the anxiety voice once again. What happens if there's something dangerous lurking in the waters? What if the currents take us away? Have you never seen a whirlpool? What if you get sucked into one of those? What about piranhas? Perhaps they're piranhas. You're in danger. She's getting frustrated and she actually sighs aloud. Really? But then the most unexpected thing happens. The voice from the app says, did anyone mention piranhas? This is a peaceful river. There are no piranhas here. Now she jumps. Her eyes are wide open. She's really freaked out, and her mouth is as open as her eyes are. Her anxiety is skyrocketing. Did the app on her phone just respond to her thoughts? She jumped to switch it off, feeling more anxious than ever. She tried to get to bed that night, tossing and turning. This strange experience had really shaken her up. She wakes up in the morning and she meets up with a friend. She's discussing with her friend the happenings of the day before, and she happens to share this story with her friend. And her friend laughs and explains to her, oh, you must be referring to the new interactive meditation app. It picks up on background noises and it adjusts its guidance accordingly. There's a Swedish proverb which teaches us, worry often gives a small thing a big shadow. Now the truth is there are some very big things in life that cast very big shadows. Some huge concerns, some genuine items of interest that cast a very large shadow. But small and even tiny things have the ability to also cast huge shadows if the light and the reflection are positioned just right. Everyone will likely remember having to do a test or some sort of exam of great importance. Heading in with all the nerves and the preparation beforehand, we sit before the examiner and we take our paper, we take our test, and we try and do our best. After completing such a test, unless everything somewhat miraculously went well and without a hitch, we start thinking about the exam, the test that we just took. We start thinking about the answers we gave, the questions we were asked, and how our material came through from us into the answers on the paper. We may even start a discussion with some friends, some of our classmates, some of our group researchers, and we would hear something that perhaps make us believe we actually made some errors. At that point, we don't know anything for certain. No one can guarantee what we did. We don't remember clearly, but we're now panicky. Did we misread some of those answers? What happens if I missed some of the questions and didn't answer them at all? Now we go to, what happens if I don't do as well? What happens if I fail altogether? We get stuck in a loop and we create such big, elaborate scenarios, such big shadows. Maybe I'm going to have to retake those modules, redo a semester. What if this whole profession isn't for me? Again, at this point, we're not sure. We don't know, but what we do is worry. It's going to be some time before we get any clarity and before we find any calm, before that final reassurance comes with our results. But we're immediately distracted. We're not available, and we're consumed by this predicament which we have just brought to life. Then something happens. The passage of time. Perhaps someone says something reassuring to us. Maybe we clear our headspace out a little bit. We realize that we likely didn't mess the whole thing up. We reread some of our notes, we go and find some of our papers, look it over once again, and now we're almost certain that we correctly addressed the questions. We followed the instructions and we performed accurately. This is still probable, and I repeat, probable. It's just that at this point, something clicked within us, it makes sense, and suddenly there's peace and calm. We can once again enjoy our lives, and it feels like color has returned to our little world. We didn't yet have any results, and that's the fascinating thing. No grade, no answer, no printed result, but something clicks within us, something was told to us, and it's enough for our minds to hold on to for now and satisfy our present fear. I thought about this and I honed in on it, and I think it presents a very interesting opportunity and actually a revelation. Because we know that life brings with it the guarantee of stress, the guarantee of noise, and the guarantee of anxiety. More often than not in life, we don't have those actual answers. We don't have the tools and the remedies, and we certainly cannot be guaranteed outcomes. But what about looking at the time and space in the middle? Once the panic response and the feelings are triggered, once we are worrying, well before we reach the other side, it's that middle area, the gray zone, if you'll call it that, where if we just had some reassurance, an aid, a tool, we could save ourselves minutes, hours, days of unnecessary anguish. And that's well before that finality arrives, whether it's good or, God forbid, otherwise. Shakespeare wrote, "Present fears are less than horrible imaginings." How do we imagine less horribly and realize the actual and genuine nature of what we fear so much? Living in 2024, especially as a Jew in 2024, and even simply as a human being on earth today in the modern world, you would be the glaring exception if you weren't familiar with stress and anxiety. Over 40 million Americans have battles with anxiety, and it's among the most common mental afflictions in this country. Between the events that continue to shape national and global progress, the challenges we face as nations of this earth, and then the wounds we keep nursing as a Jewish people, the anxiety we feel is so often rampant and even palpable. Here's a very important factor at the outset. As people seem to do, when we don't have clarity about things going a certain way, we worry more. We berate ourselves. We just want feelings to stop. We almost demand of ourselves an immediate shift. I must not feel wound up now. I must dismiss this pit in my stomach. I must immediately draw my attention back to what I am doing and be stronger than these silly, trivial worries. Be stronger than worrying about my children, about my community, about my beloved Holy Land. The golden key to begin with is to accept. It's not a denial and a waging of war on how we feel. It's not a shooing away of our emotions. It's acceptance of the fact that we feel a certain way. It is intense out there. 2024 is new territory for everyone on the planet. And the fact that we feel out of it, otherwise woozy of sorts, that's par for the course. A massive breakthrough has occurred this year in Africa. Africa is close to my heart. It's where I am born and bred, in the south of Africa. But this breakthrough took place in Kenya, and it took place in the field of medical sciences, but not with human beings. It took place with animals. If you're familiar with animal life and different species, you may be aware of the northern white rhino. The northern white rhinoceros is a declared extinct species with only two females in existence on Earth. The medical breakthrough related to these two northern white rhinos is that through miraculous medical treatments and the use of IVF, one of them was able to fall pregnant. They were able to use a stored specimen and IVF to create a pregnancy in a northern white rhino. All being well, another white rhino calf will be born this year. And you think of the fascination of that. And think of that, what that means for our people and for humanity and for the animal life of the world, literally bringing back a species from the dead. Incredibly empowering, but think of where we're at in this world. Think of the advances, the movement, and the capabilities of what's going on around us. Then shifting to technological. For the last three decades, supercomputers have gotten about 10 times faster every 4 years or so. I'm going to put this into context and we'll realize just how fast we're speaking. In May of 2022, the global supercomputer rankings were shaken up by the introduction of a supercomputer named Frontier. Frontier is now the fastest supercomputer in the world. It can perform 1 quintillion floating point operations per second. 1 quintillion, I didn't know either, is a 1 followed by 18 zeros, and that number has its own name, an exaflop. Essentially, the Frontier can perform as many calculations in just 1 second as 100,000 laptops. That's a supercomputer. With the launch of Frontier located at Oak Ridge National Laboratory in Tennessee, this era of exascale computing officially began. And several more joined the race worldwide. In the US alone, researchers are working on 2 different supercomputers that will be about twice as fast. The El Capitan in California and the Aurora being worked on in Illinois. Today, we are so in it. What's going on around us and the rapid rate of that growth and of that change is unmatched in history. And many of us have that feeling like we're just trying to cope. We're just trying to keep our heads above water. The anxiety and stresses, though, feel relatively new. It almost seems as if this concept just popped up in very recent years. It popped up and then came a pandemic and world unrest, coupled with a society totally caught off balance by a rapidly changing environment, and the stress lever was taken and bolted up a few notches. But is it new? Are these anxieties and stresses really something new? I believe that it's all just gotten more airtime. We've given it new names and we've shared it everywhere. It's a feeling we've all had. It's a noise we've often heard. It's now been identified. And now we have recognized it. It's difficult to unidentify or unfeel it. You've probably heard people speak of our times and this generation, that this feeling that we have is all a symptom of the world as we know it. We hear them and we believe it. It's perhaps a curse of living in this era. But human beings are quick to forget. Forgetfulness is a beautiful gift. It's a gift that Hashem gave us to give us the ability to move on, to move past, and to grow. But we have to remember, we do forget. So join me in taking a moment to reflect. Let's reflect as far back as the beginning of mankind, when Adam and Eve committed the very first sins in the paradise of Gan Eden, of the Garden of Eden. You can only attempt to imagine what the atmosphere must have been at that time. Suddenly, the entire dynamic of a young universe shifted. God's disappointment was felt, and along with that, consequences, pain, loss, and grief entered the picture. It is so obvious that with this great shakeup came great emotions. Great bewilderment, huge distress, facing an entirely different reality and a tarnished picture of a future that we had envisioned, you could really believe that the first couple on earth were anxious. And then, as recent as within the past century, I'm personally a very empathetic person. I find it greatly difficult to watch content, to read content from the era of World War II around the Holocaust. And again, I don't think that I'm different from most. But it strikes you at the core. I struggle to even watch reenactments. It hits you in your very essence of being. It's obviously painful for everyone who thinks about it and who reflects back. This makes me wonder, though, this very new syndrome of the 2020s, anxiety, how did it look back then? Take a moment to try and think and feel. Try virtually slide into the lives of our parents, grandparents, and great-grandparents on the brink of a heinous world war. Seeing the hatred of Jews rise around you and feeling those walls closing in. Think of ushering your children into ghettos. Need I elaborate more? The unknown, the horror. What we sometimes gloss over when looking back is that fear, that anxiety, and that stress. Because we're so overcome with disbelief and bewilderment over that particular period in time, we don't have the capacity to think of the nuances of the stresses felt. I try to take the place myself of a young parent at the time, a newlywed, perhaps the place of a teenager in the prime of their lives, contrasting with an environment like that. Surely you can be assured of the noise and the anxieties that must have been present at that time. How did they face another day? How did they face another minute? It must have been paralyzing and suffocating. With this example as a springboard, we can keep going back throughout our history, throughout the script of our beautiful history. You can shed light on some of the anxieties we must have faced collectively as a nation. Past the pogroms, go through the expulsions and the exiles as the people moved over the millennia. Mentally travel back to our people's time in Egypt. Egypt, a place which had been so abundantly good for us, a place of plenty, a place of such comfort. The Jewish people moved to Egypt. We weren't forced there. We moved to Egypt. We enjoyed life there. It was a place that must have felt wonderful, optimistic, and serene. It was a location where we lived and we built our communities, our Jewish families, our yeshivas. We thrived in Egypt. Then came the distress. The definition of exile came. Slavery and torture, brutality and murder. And this wasn't just for a year or two. It was prolonged agony over decades. I try to think of what those anxieties must have looked like. Families in slavery waking up each day to face more uncertainty and wicked abuse. Generations huddled in small hut homes as miraculous plagues lashed the Egyptian landscape. An entire nation fleeing as a unit in haste. Men, women, children together, young and old, grabbing whatever their hands could hold and running on foot. Running away from a superpower who had kept them captive for so long. Do you feel it? in the thick of the night, facing frightening terrain ahead and the shimmer of Egypt behind you in the distance. What will be? What will come next? Even mentally replaying it can put you on edge. Then join me. Stand with me on the banks of the Yam Suf, the Reed Sea, just a few days later. Waves are beating that shoreline again. People are growing weary in pockets of conversation. Thousands of people are standing in a vast open space. Children are crying. There's nervousness, hunger, exhaustion. Here behind you, the approach of a tenacious and mighty army. What helped? What was it that burst the bubble for our people and stopped us from succumbing to ourselves, succumbing to the very real fears we faced? Nachshon ben Aminadav. Nachshon, the son of Aminadav. A brave man, step by step forward, he walked into those powerful ocean waters. He stepped forward further and further until the waters just about overcame him. With this action, God changed the course of history, splitting the waters of the sea, providing safe passage to the Jewish people, and destroying the enemy army hot in pursuit. Nachshon's actions were clear heroism, but also bold messages for us in our pursuit of quietening the noise. When we experience our own anxious state, the best possible focus is a forward focus. Try not to surrender to the fear. Try not to turn back to Egypt and try not to lay down. To take that deep breath, focus on where we're heading, and then take a step. Into the waters, even if they're up to our necks, keep moving in a positive direction. When we're able to pull our minds back to doing something, anything, productive and good, when we choose to keep progressing, then we can be assured of God's assistance in splitting oceans for us and blazing that path that we need for our safe passage. In the book of Psalms in Tehillim, King David wrote, "I have sunk into muddy depths, and there's no place to stand. I've come into deep water, and the current has swept me away. Let not the current of water sweep me away, nor the deep swallow me, and let the well not close its mouth over me." King David was referencing Nachshon, the son of Aminadav. The Lubavitcher Rebbe teaches us that Nachshon knew what God wanted of the Jewish people. But Nachshon had no obligation and a personal capacity to carry anything out. He wasn't in a position of leadership. He wasn't the Moshe. He wasn't Moses. He was one of the many. He didn't have any obligation to do so, but he took a step forward, plowing through the sea towards his goal. And it's a lesson for us all in our life's mission to try to disregard the obstacles. Anxiety is one such obstacle, and one way to attempt at disregarding it is to focus forward. There's a man by the name of Rick. Rick was a person who was very nervy, a nervous person, quite panicky, and he had a particular and specific phobia. He had a fear of getting his hair cut. Very specific. One can't be blamed for having a specific or different phobia. We all have our specific fears. This was Rick's. Rick wasn't afraid of the scissors. He wasn't afraid of the machinery. He wasn't afraid of the environment of the barbershop. That wasn't what put him on edge. It was the fear that he'd end up with a hairstyle he didn't like or want. His anxiety painted the most incredible pictures of him leaving that barbershop with a mohawk, a reverse mullet, some sort of new craze haircut. That's what he feared. One day, Rick took a deep breath and he decided he's going to face his fear head on. He found the newest, trendiest barbershop in his area, and he made an appointment. He walked in. It felt very upmarket, upscale, edgy, different. He was comfortable. It had very ornate mirrors by each seat. What was a little strange is that those mirrors were covered by beautiful satin curtains. The mirrors weren't visible. He didn't mind that. He sat down and he started to describe to the barber his favorite style of haircut. There was a slogan up in the shop that conveyed the premise of this new trendy barbershop. You would get a haircut without seeing the progress during the cut, and there'd be a grand reveal at the very end. Now, Rick read this and started to get nervous. What if I come out here with neon-colored hair? His anxiety was whispering throughout the process. Finally, the moment he had dreaded began and the haircut began, he started hearing the snipping away. Every time those scissors came close to his ear, or he felt the buzzing of the machine or the cold steel of one piece of equipment, he was on edge once again. Finally, the barber walked away and said that the cut was finished. Rick now braced himself for this grand reveal. Those beautiful satin curtains were pulled away, and Rick was scared to open his eyes. He didn't know what would be looking back at him. He opened those eyes, and he started laughing. His hair looked exactly the same as when he had walked in. The barber smiled at him. First-timers get the trust cut. It's just a trim to help you trust us. Throughout the Torah, in its simplicity and then in the depths of Chassidus and Kabbalah, enormous portions of our sacred works are dedicated to our trust in God, our emunah, our bitachon, simply translated as our belief, faith, and trust in God. One of the well-known portions of daily prayer is a small paragraph which begins with the words, Al Tira, meaning, do not fear, do not be afraid. This prayer references the guidance to our people to have no fear from current difficult happenings, frightening happenings, wicked enemies, because our people are assured of the protection of our Father in heaven. If I were to highlight and embolden the words to hold tightly onto, the words would be Al Tira and Ki Immanuel. Do not fear, because God is with us. What's so important here is the acknowledgement that there may very well be reason or reasons to be afraid indeed. Just by this instruction that Hashem gives us, we are provided with validation. You may have reasons to worry, but here you're given reassurance not to worry or to not worry. Hashem, God Himself, tells us that worry is unfounded and unnecessary. We can be firmly aware of Hashem's guidance and Hashem's protection. The Lubavitcher Rebbe wrote many letters of responsa over very many years to many, many different people of different walks of life. It's interesting to note how many of these were related to mental health, to challenges with things like stress and anxiety, no matter what was causing them. I have excerpts from two different letters which bring home a very important point and message in our efforts to control or deal with some of the noise in the world. In a faith-themed letter, which is still poignant today, written decades ago, the Rebbe writes, "One ought to know once and for all that faith is not something that is meant to remain only in one's thoughts. It must permeate the whole of one's life. You are, without a doubt, a believer. So the very first point of belief is that God directs this world. And if God is capable of directing 1.5 billion people, then your affairs will certainly see the fulfillment of the verse, I have made you and I will carry you. I will sustain you and deliver you." Now think this over, the Rebbe says. God promises, I will sustain and deliver you. So think, can anyone from any land disturb God from fulfilling his promise? Having thought that, consider, is God really in need of our worry as how he is going to run our affairs and solve our problems? Or will God succeed in finding good solutions even without our worrying? The answer is obvious. In the separate letter, the Rebbe advises two possible approaches to live with. Firstly, the Rebbe says, either you will walk around worried in case, God forbid, blessings won't be fulfilled in your life. And then when the blessing actually materializes and is fulfilled, you'll have a fresh worry. Why did you have to waste so much time worrying in vain? Why did you waste so much energy? Or option B, you will be staunch in your trust and faith in God, that he will lead you along the right path and will fulfill all the blessings that you have been given. And then, when you see them being fulfilled in actual fact, you'll be able to tell yourself, just look how well I handled that situation. I didn't worry about things that were of no cause for concern. The Rebbe says, be happy because with God's help, the problems that you imagine to be so serious will be solved. You have nothing to worry about. Be happy and fulfill the directive of the verse. Serve God with joy. A young student approached the famous French scientist and philosopher Blaise Pascal, and he declared to Pascal, if I had your brains, I would be a better person. Pascal stood and pondered the depth of that statement. He paused momentarily before replying, be a better person, and you will have my brains. We cannot always change our lot or the hand that we've been dealt in life. We don't always find the strength and that wherewithal to climb out of whatever challenging arena we find ourselves in. What we can do, though, is change the framing. We can lay down productive steps to build on. Linked closely to faith, to emunah and bitachon, is this incredible and useful support to build and rely on. The famed Tzemach Tzedek lived in the years 1789 to 1866. He coined the Yiddish saying, Tracht gut, wird sein gut. Think good, and it will be good. Tracht gut, wird sein gut. If you haven't come to memorize or to know it already, it's a good one to have on the tip of your tongue. Tracht gut, wird sein gut. Think good, and it will be good. This captures the Jewish and Torah attitude. The optimism of Jewish people predates any current bestsellers and any viral lectures on the topics of positivity. The way we think, the way we act, the way we speak can actually change our reality. Everyone is entitled to their own opinion of the slogan, fake it till you make it. But believing positively, speaking positively, and even acting like everything is going swimmingly and well, when the odds may be against it all, that positivity doesn't only carry us through, it can change the course of where we're heading for the better. Hearing our mind say, well, this is going to be awful, and then slamming that thought down. Feeling our mouths verbalize how much has gone wrong today, and rather choosing to soul search and share something positive, something upbeat. These empowering actions can change our entire aura. They'll change them for us and for everyone around us. The truest aspect of this secret is that it works even if it starts off a little bit fake and a little bit half-hearted. There was a baby mosquito taking his inaugural flight. There was excitement as the parents were letting their baby go for his first trip out into the world. He took flight, and they waited eagerly for their little baby's return. The mosquito flew back to a warm reception from his mother and father. And his father turns to him as he lands and says, how did it feel? How was it? How was your first trip out? The little mosquito replies to his father, it was wonderful, Daddy. All the humans clapped hands for me. It's all about the framing. A journalist by the name of Emma Beddington wrote quite a humorous article some time ago when she expresses a funny angle, on a question, a theoretical question that was posed to her. What's the most stressful moment of your day? Somewhat jokingly in the article, she settles on one moment after another, working through the time frame of her day as it plays out. She says, maybe it's when I wake up and all my thoughts envelop me. No, that's upstaged by when my kids wake up and it's breakfast time, the rush and the chaos. Maybe that's the most stressful. And she moves on to her daily commute and work, getting home from work, etc., as each stress seems to upstage the next. The thing is, Emma writes, we as a people are still evolutionarily maladapted to deal with the world in which we find ourselves. None of our fight or flight stuff is turning out to be particularly helpful for dealing with constant aggressive digital stimuli, the melting Antarctic, the latest flu, flesh-eating opioids, etc., etc. We're reporting higher levels of stress all the time. And she quotes an Ipsos research piece that says last year, 60% of participants across 34 countries have reported that they have felt stressed just this year to the point that they felt they couldn't cope or deal with things in their life. Emma continues with her humor in quipping that if we really wanted to assist with stress, there's so many little things that would help. Put phone chargers, public toilets, and water fountains everywhere for a start. Require all customer service helplines to pay you $10 for every minute you're on hold. Let us choose our own hold music. Nationalize Wi-Fi. Introduce a degree in improving autocorrect. She says, ban the sale of sticky tape that splits into multiple tiny, unimaginable ends. Ah, she says, I would feel calmer already. We likely know of the dozens of tips, tricks, and hacks and helps that are out there to try aid us in finding the solace we so desire and wish for. I'd like to add another fantastic one. American novelist Anne Lamont writes, almost everything will work again if you unplug it for a few minutes, including you. Isaac and Albert Farhi are two brothers who live in Israel. The brothers together operate and own a successful jewelry store, and they have had it in the family for some time. A story recently took place with the Farhi's jewelry store, and it took place going into a Shabbos, going into Shabbat. Friday afternoon came, and as they do, religious, observant Jews, they had closed up their store, locked away most of the stock. And in the back of their jewelry store, they had a very serious safe. In that safe, all the high-value jewelry was to be locked away, kept under the safety of the passcode for the duration of the closure of the store over the weekend. And they say that at this particular point, this Shabbos, there was almost $1 million worth of jewelry in the safe at the time. The brothers went home for Shabbos. They'd started getting ready for Shabbat, prepared themselves. They found themselves sitting around the table, just beginning the meal, and the phone rings. The phone goes to a voicemail, which is projected aloud, and they hear it's the security company. The security company is saying there's been an alarm in your jewelry store. It's in zone 3. Please come down to the shop. Zone 3 gets them edgy, because zone 3 is where the safe is, at the back of the shop. They turn to each other, and they're obviously a little bit nervous. What should we do? Should we act on it? The decision is taken, no, we're not going to do anything. It's going to interfere with Shabbos. We're keeping Shabbos. We want to keep the right energy with our family. We're going to ignore it to the best of our ability and continue. Phone rings again and again and again. And it continues ringing throughout the duration of their meal. And it makes them uncomfortable, but they've made a decision. They're not letting this interfere with their Shabbos. As soon as Shabbos finishes, Saturday night comes, they make their way quickly to the store to see what actually transpired. And to their surprise, the gate on the shop is still down, no windows are broken. It's a strange scene for the amount of calls they got and for the alarm. They open up and they start to see damage. They do see things strewn around, nothing major. Things are missing, there's a mess in the shop. But Albert is holding his breath for the main event, if you will, to go and open that safe and see if anything's missing. He speaks about the fact that it took him 5 minutes to enter that code because his hand was shaking uncontrollably, a code he entered every single day, but he couldn't get the numbers to dial. He opens it slowly. Everything is as it was. Nothing was touched. He's thankful to Hashem. He breathes a huge sigh of relief. And he starts to lock up again, tidy up, and head out the store with his brother. There are police passing by, and they see action in the store Saturday night late. It's unusual. They stop in and say, is everything okay? What's going on here? The Farahi brothers relate this strange story, and the police tell them, "You don't know how lucky you are that you keep Shabbos." It's a new criminal mode of operation in these types of stores, in jewelry stores. This is what criminals are doing. They're not coming in through the window. They're not coming in through the front. They're coming in through the roof. And what they do in high-value jobs such as these is they purposely set off the alarm because they want the store owner to visit. The store owner visiting gives them access to the safe. So that's why these people had set off the alarm repeatedly in the hopes that the store owner would come. And the police say, in the cases we have dealt with, none have ended well for the store owners. Vicious criminals, and your lives have quite literally been saved. We are taught that more than the Jews have kept Shabbos, Shabbos has kept the Jews safe. I would venture to add, not only safe, but sane. Shabbos and festivals, Shabbos and Yom Tov are majestic times of connecting to Hashem. We experience the magnificence of our religious traditions and we bond in space and time in a cocoon with our loved ones. In addition to the huge merits and the spiritual depths of both Shabbos and the Chagim, the festivals, they've offered us something so unique. Something which I personally have come to appreciate more and more each week and each year. It's that ability to switch off, to disconnect. With the improvements that were made in charging and battery design, most of us are probably used to leaving our phones switched on. Computers, phones switched on, we often plug them into the charger and leave them on. You walk into offices and you see multiple computer screens just sitting on, whether they're in use or not. Gone are the days of our close familiarity with our phones booting up daily, systems loading, as on a whole, we rarely require this process. A fun phone fact, which comes to you from the phone technicians. Regular restarts of a phone can prevent freezes and ensure smoother performance. Interesting to note that in a phone's case, restarting a phone clears out the background apps, heating issues, memory problems, and troubles with call signal. Wouldn't we all appreciate a tonic that could aid us in clearing out our background apps, while also helping us maybe receive better signal, regulate us, and as a bonus, probably help us retain some more memory? God, in his wisdom, provided us with an exclusive operating platform for just this. And I'm not sure we provide enough value to it. To have a scheduled calendar day every week, and then seasonal days as well, allocated and reserved for us to disconnect from the rush of the world, to power down all the buzz, the hype, the endless scrolling, the alerts, and of course, to curb the weight and pressure of the media's endless rants of news. All screens, all devices put aside, our minds get to exhale. Our eyes get some rest. Our ears get to recognize the old familiar sounds of quiet. And our hearts can find their rhythmic pulse returning to satisfactory levels. If you've not yet had the merit to experience this bliss, I urge you to give it a chance. After 24 or 48 hours at times of being able to be present, parents making eye contact with children, children feeling that they actually have their parents' attention, friends enjoying each other's company. After not having the barrage and the bombardment of the world's wild sounds, you come to the end of these special refuge zones and you are so hesitant to turn the volume back up. There's no need to turn the volume back up because the assurance is there. Shabbos returns next week and our Yomim Tovim, our festivals, our Chagim, one of them is always on the horizon. Many psychologists have already commented on the damage wrought to the psyche and to the emotions by the constant connection to social media. It's much better to connect to your friends in person, to real friends, in a real life way, in a direct way, to avoid the pitfalls of constant virtuality and then the potential animosity that anonymity breeds. I'm sure we can all understand messages getting lost in translation. WhatsApp, messaging, amazing tools of connection to bring us closer, but so many times lacking the emotion and the soul, and left to the receiver's interpretation, creating unnecessary friction, doubt. What did they mean? Was that said in a kind fashion? Was that meant to sting me? Potential animosity, difficulty, because we're not connecting face to face. Joining with you all at a retreat such as this really gives credibility to the antidote, the feeling of belonging, the feeling of connecting, of growing, of learning together. The feeling that we have here of essentially being a family of souls is unsurpassed. So another great remedy for the symptoms of our time, something that has and will always remain true to us, lifting us up and keeping us strong, supporting one another, standing united, in person as opposed to virtually. In every person's very different challenges in facing all that is transpiring around us, I urge you to incorporate the sagely wisdom of the Torah and our history. Reassured that we are in fact living in phenomenal times, and then equipped with the behavior modeled in the generations before us, we can aim to leave the reins in God's hands and know that God knows exactly what he is doing. Capitalize on the unplugged oasis of Shabbos and Yom Tov, handed to us quite literally on a silver platter, just when we need it most. Work on making our default mindset a more positive one, and our heart and energies will follow. We can ensure that we are progressing and throw ourselves into areas of forward focus and growth. And we can do this all leaning on those we love, surrounded by those who care so much for us all. Thank you for joining me.
Please visit myjli.com to learn more about JLI's multiple educational offerings.